Welcome to The Apartment Guys, where we dive deep into all things multifamily investing. Our mission is to educate, inspire, and empower real estate investors to reach their highest potential. Each week, host Tate Seymour interviews high-level guests from all over the industry who are sure to bring valuable, actionable ideas that will propel your career to the next level. Whether you're just starting out or a seasoned investor, you are in the right place. And now your host, the apartment guy, Tate Seymour.
Great. Well, here we are, another episode of the Apartment Guys podcast. And we are once again so lucky to have an absolute rock star in the multifamily space with us today. Anna Myers serves as the vice president at Grow Capitus, which is a commercial investment company in the San Francisco Bay Area. She's a third generation commercial real estate entrepreneur who has 25 plus years of experience in technology and business. And she applies that to finding, analyzing, acquiring, and asset managing commercial properties in key markets around the US, together with the legendary Neil Bawa, the mad scientist of multifamily himself. Anna and Neil are business partners, and they approach real estate through a data science lens to create a compelling profits for over 1,000 investors. We'll talk a little bit about your data analysis and your market analysis and your ninja skills with that. Can't wait to get into that. Anna is the lead underwriter for the company and teaches deal analysis for Multifamily U in quarterly boot camps. I highly recommend checking that out. Multifamily U, all one word with the letter U at the end. It's apartment investing education company owned by Neil and Anna. And Anna hosts weekly webinar events as well, featuring top speakers in real estate. She's regularly interviewed on podcasts. She was at the top of my list to get on, and so I'm so thrilled. And Anna and Neil on the syndication side have completed equity raises of over $25 million.
That number's out of date, Tate, I have to say.
And that was over the last 12 months. Okay, so
that's even out of date. I'm not sure where they got that from. It's like over 53 million in the last 12 months.
Well, there you go. So
big difference.
Yeah, and then I've got you on track with resulting in over 1,300 units.
1,800,
and on track to close another. I'll just let you say it.
Well, we're in a pandemic, so let's just keep our numbers tight. We were trying to shoot for another, 1,200, 1,500. We'll see if we get there, Sure. But, we're actively pursuing deals and taking them down.
Yeah.
I'll say 800.
There you go.
800.
And here 800 here in the rest of 2020 or in the next?
In the next 12 months. So just to be on the record, it is July 31st.
Right.
So, and we are 3.5-4 months into a pandemic. So we are looking for great opportunity moving forward in multiple asset classes and different sizes. We're looking at different size projects as well that we wouldn't have necessarily been looking at.
Yeah, we are too, actually. Yeah. So in summary, as asset manager for the Grow Capitus portfolio, Anna brings that data-driven approach from her business and tech days to track and insert optimizations to the properties to help drive property performance and investor returns. So just Anna, once again, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Nice being here with you.
Yeah.
Nice to hang out with you again.
Yeah, totally. I so appreciate that. So I know your story, at least to a certain degree, and you definitely have such a background that's so steeped in commercial real estate investing, right down to your grandfather was an investor.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So I am the 16th grandchild, the youngest grandchild to a commercial real estate maverick, really. Mm. My grandfather lived in Florida and he saw what was happening in Southern California in real estate. I think he was a real estate agent or something in Tampa. And he sold everything and moved to Los Angeles. And back then it was just, fields. I mean, there wasn't much. It was just early days. Mm. And he basically flipped houses to start his real estate investing career there. And then became a developer. My grandfather's very, very savvy entrepreneur. He started developing land and was eventually buying walnut groves and orange groves and building shopping malls on them. And
wow.
In the history books of LA, real estate development, he's actually in there because he was the guy, and we all think that we all know this, like it's so obvious now, but he's the guy that figured out that you should put your shopping malls, you should put them by freeway exits. Like, duh.
Right.
But people hadn't figured that out yet. So he's credited with being like, you know what? This is where we should put it. And so he was very strategic about location, which I, as his grandchild, very strategic about location. So I guess I get that from him. Yeah. And then the other thing he's credited with is the anchor store concept for shopping malls. So having one or two large anchor stores, people didn't used to do that. He's the one that started that in LA. And so anyway, thought leader for his time. My father's an architect. My uncles are both, you know, in they all ran the large portfolio that my grandfather accumulated. And so I grew up in that kind of background. That was my background. But as the youngest grandchild, I didn't work in the real estate office. I didn't work at my dad's architect office because all my older siblings did and my older cousins did. I was just a little, little Anna, you know. I actually wanted to become an actress. So I was a stage actress as a child in LA and really loved that. And I thought that was where I wanted to be. I've always been I'm one of those people that's both a science and math person as well as an art person. And my parents never knew what I was going to become. They're like, no idea what you're going to do in life because which path are you going to take, art or math? And that decision was made pretty early on to me when I, as a teenager, had a child. And I was a single parent at that time. I was actually going to UC Berkeley. And I graduated very early from high school. So I was very young attending UC Berkeley. And I had had a baby, a little girl, and was a single mom. And decided I needed to, you know, in order to support her, I became a programmer. And at that time, I could make a really good hourly wage at $45 an hour for a very young person, which is very substantial. And so I would work a couple days a week and you know, spend the other days in school. And that way I was able to support myself and buy diapers and all that type of stuff. And then the hope was, because once my child was born, I became an avid photographer to document her life. And the hope was that I could afford to buy film as well. So that was always the thing. So yeah, so that's how I got into my tech career. And I had a great career in tech. I, you know, from a programmer, I quickly evolved into becoming a systems architect and was running very large teams worldwide, building out, you know, enterprise portals and doing lots of stuff. I'm just like an organizer in my brain. I see data and I organize it. And I'm good at organizing people too, evidently. So that all just kind of came together. But then the tech industry crashed in 2000. And I had a great career in tech, but suddenly they were asking me to make a third of what I'd been making. Now note that, remember my grandfather, that entrepreneur, and my dad, architect, also entrepreneur, they always told me, you know, don't work for other people, work for yourself. So I guess I was a little, I didn't think it was that unusual, but you know, from the time I was in my 20s, I had an S corp and I worked for myself. I didn't work a W-2 job. So as a programmer, I was always an independent contractor and systems architect, all that. So when they wanted to reduce my wages, my earnings, you know, not W-2, but my hourly wage to like a third, I was like, I'm not working for that. And so I did what anyone would do. I started a photography studio in the San Francisco Bay Area. Made sense to me at the time. No, my husband was also, at that time I'd gotten married by that time, and my husband was also in the tech industry. So it really hit our household very hard, the crash in 2000. So I migrated into photography and opened a studio. I was a digital photographer because I took all of the skills I had from computers. And that was kind of my edge into the photography, the professional photography world. I'd been shooting all along and people were always saying, man, you should be a photographer. I said, do you know how much money I make in programming as a systems architect? I can never afford to be a photographer. Well, then it turned out I could afford to be a photographer. So anyway, fast forward, as a photographer, I had a great had my studio, developed a wonderful business, was widely recognized as a, you know, contributor to maternity and portrait and some event photography. But what I also learned is that when you're really good at business and you're making good money, the IRS likes to take most of it. So that was my challenge, is that I was working my tail off, very successful, and almost all of my money went to paying taxes. And I just thought, this is terrible. And how do I solve this? Because I'm a problem solver. So I said, how do I solve this? And then I said, I went back to real estate, right? Because everybody in my family is real estate investors. So I started buying single families and duplexes to help with the to add depreciation so that I could overcome my tax challenges. And guess what? It works. We all know it works, right? That's why we're sitting in the, that's why we're listening to this podcast. Real estate is an amazing vehicle to help in all kinds of ways, including your taxes, which is really key. So in the process of that, I realized, you know, what am I doing? I basically own a job. What I could do is instead is I could really scale into real estate, because that is going to allow me to provide generational wealth for my family and allow me to scale into the life that I want to have in my future. Photography was keeping me grounded in one city, working one job. And me, my goal, I want to be an artist. You know, I want to go back to being that artist. I was never, you know, I was never going to get there through photography, which becomes a grind when you're doing art for other people. It does become a daily grind versus a creative outlet. Anyway, that's how I then merged back into real estate and started doing that full time. I set a 4-year goal to get there. And that's what I did. I migrated full time and into commercial real estate. And now I am a multifamily syndicator.
Yeah. And a very successful one at that, and a very generous one in that you are so well recognized for being a teacher and a coach and educator and a thought leader. And yeah, and you and Neil are really well known for your data-driven approach. We were lucky enough to have Neil on the podcast a number of episodes ago. And we talked quite a bit about, you know, the data analysis and market analysis, specifically in relation to what's going on right now with COVID. And when we had Neil on it, it was maybe 2 or 3 weeks after things really hit the fan, so to speak.
Which time when things hit the fan? Well, hit the fan so many times in the last 4 months.
yeah. This was the one that were the stock market dropped, I can't remember how many, you know, 1,000 points in one day. And the NBA shutdown was kind of the first.
Okay. So that was when people were like, this is a real thing. And so now we're at the point where people are trying to lead their lives and kind of, this is our new normal. And yet, you know, 2 days ago, the GDP dropped the greatest amount in recorded history for economic data. So we're still, the stock market is pretty much back up, if not higher than it was. Is that right, Tate? I mean, it's the stock market, no one's talking about that anymore. I mean, it has some good days and bad days, but it's definitely come back up. But now the GDP has hit the fan, right?
Right. Yeah. And where we're headed from here is you could say is anybody's guess, but one of the beautiful things about working with data and being a data approach is that it does give you at least some sort of ability to quantify all of this kind of chaos, I guess. And and you can take real world numbers like unemployment, GDP, and apply it to market analysis and underwriting. So, you know, from an investor's standpoint, I guess what I'm very interested in hearing your thoughts on are, how do you underwrite now differently? And I know that that's like a big question because there's lots of different things, I'm sure, but, and do you even underwrite or, you know, like,
what do you underwrite these days? Right.
Exactly. Like, you know, like, in other words, are the unknowns so unknown that it's most prudent to sit things out, or do we take advantage of a window when maybe a lot of other people are sitting out and stay relatively aggressive? You know, that's what our company's looking at on a, you know, on a daily basis. And that's, we've definitely changed our thinking in terms, we're looking at quite a bit smaller projects now than we were before COVID. And we're looking strictly in Utah, which I know is a market that you guys love. And
we love it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd like to get into that just a little bit more later, but just curious, like, obviously, I know you guys are doing deals and you're always looking at deals and underwriting. So it doesn't seem like you've slowed down a whole lot. But what are your thoughts overall on the underwriting climate these days?
Well, I mean, I do think that it all goes back to data. So in terms, you know, before you underwrite something, you have to make sure that you're in the right market and in the right asset class for the time frame. So we, of course, had to like everybody, look at where and what. And mm-hmm. so, of course, we use data for that. But I also want to say that before the pandemic even hit in late 2019 and early 2020, as a company, we were already pivoting because we were seeing that multifamily, like the juice was just kind of squeezed out of it and it was really hard to squeeze it any more. So we were already pivoting and looking at deals that could be more nimble and quick, which led us to start looking at smaller deals that had multiple exits. So we weren't just not just deals that we could, like large apartment buildings that we could only sell to, you know, REITs or, you know, apartment players, but we started looking at developing quads and doing urban infill with mm-hmm. quad projects that could be 1031 or, you know, we actually have a project in Houston that's in an opportunity zone. So there's so many more exits you can do. And then we leveraged that project to say, so it's all individually parceled quads on very small urban infill areas. We leveraged that project once the pandemic hit to say, what is the biggest issue a real estate investor faces? It's still in the pandemic, but from the beginning, what is the biggest fear of somebody that owns a unit or a quad? That your investor isn't going to pay rent, or that your tenant is not going to pay rent, and mm-hmm. that you can't pay the debt, right? Mm-hmm. So we thought, how do we take this equation out? Well, we took the equation out by saying one of the pivots for this project is to sell seven. In this case, we're building 16. We were building two 16 plexes. If we sell seven of them, then we could pay off the construction loan and own the property debt free. Mm. So that was a major differentiator. So I think these days you really have to think differently. It's not mm-hmm. about just sitting down at your spreadsheet and going about business as usual. You have to take a step away from the underwriting table and turn everything on its head. You know, you can't just look at things and go at it normally. So we're still looking at new construction, but smaller projects. One of the benefits of that smaller project too, again, debt is very fickle these days. So you have to look at debt, what the lenders are willing to lend on. And one of the things they're willing to lend on is small residential projects. Smaller projects are much more attractive to lend on in general. Smaller construction projects, smaller apartment buildings, they're much less risky. But look at who's going to buy from us, okay? Who's going to buy from us are people that are going to be getting residential loans. Residential loans are not difficult these days. Lowest interest rate, you know, like it's easy to get a residential loan. It's much harder to get commercial loans, right? That's where you need the resume and all that. So these are some of the pivots that we're making and the ways that we're looking at it to bring in new types of assets and new types of opportunities for our investors and to de-risk them. That's what we're all about. How do we de-risk this? We still want to provide handsome returns, right? There's still opportunity to be had. We're looking for that opportunity and looking for the returns that we think are going to be very compelling to our investors. But de-risking is very important to us. Mm-hmm. So we're also looking at a new asset class. We've just launched our first project in it, which is flex industrial. And people might say, well, flex industrial, aren't you guys multifamily? Well, yeah, we're multifamily. We've got some student housing. We have a little bit of storage. And now we have flex industrial. Well, why do we have that? Because the data pointed us there. And the data has been pointing us there for the past 6-9 months because of e-commerce. E-commerce was growing at 15%, which is a very compelling number, right? 15% mm-hmm. is crazy.
Yeah.
Well, guess what the latest number is for e-commerce? E-commerce has grown between May 2019 and June 2020, 77%. Wow. And most of that growth is post-COVID.
I was just going to say, yeah.
The world, in some sense, the world is turned on its head. Yeah. And we have to sit up and pay attention. And mm-hmm. we're far enough into this pandemic that we've got data to look at, right? Mm-hmm. The early days, it was difficult, right? Because you're like, I just don't know. I don't know what's right. going to happen. Well, now right. we're far enough in where we really are seeing who are the winners and who are the losers mm-hmm. of this, right? And we're really happy. Multifamily is not a loser. Real estate investors should be really proud that they are not losers. People have to have a place to live. You have to shelter someplace. You have to have a place to live. So we are an essential service. It's tricky dealing with, you know, some of the not being able to evict and all that type of stuff. But I think that we're going to be fine in the long run. But look at other asset classes. Self-storage is not the same that it was in the earlier recession. I think you have to be very careful with self-storage. our project is going very well. We're not seeing any challenges with occupancy. We're not seeing any challenges with rent. But some markets are seeing big dips in rent because the REITs are like driving down the rents because those markets might be oversupplied with self-storage. So you can't, again, you can't just look at the 2008, 2007 and say, well, what worked then? What works every recession? That's not always true. Mm-hmm. I would say it's true for multifamily because you can never change the fact that our rentals in general, that people need a place to live. But you have to carefully look at all of the different assets. So now that you've done that, then you can start looking at the underwriting. So let's talk about the Flex Industrial. Flex Industrial is projected to have, for forecast for 2020 is 6.8% rent growth in the US. That's the largest rent growth of any commercial real estate asset projection. Okay. And that, I believe that's Cushman Wakefield that projected that, or CBRE, one of the big dogs. So look for assets that have the rent growth. But what did we underwrite at? We underwrote it at 1%. In a market that, you know, a space that's exploding, but we're still going to be very conservative and underwrite it at 1%. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're underwriting, you know, multifamily or some other things, many people are underwriting negative rent growth for the first few years. And that can make it very difficult to make a deal pencil because many people's underwriting only penciled because they were using bridge loans and very aggressive rent growth. Mm-hmm. And now you don't have either of those to use.
Right.
So you have to find the deals that really make sense in terms of the value add component and just in terms of the loss to lease opportunity that the deal is so undervalued, the market rents are so low. And so you really have to scratch and find the good stuff. The stuff that was retraded over and over and over again that we've been seeing for the past 5 years, that's not the stuff that you can go buy anymore. Bridge loans are pretty much, we're not interested in bridge loans at 6.5%, 7.5%, 8.5%. We will not take our investors down that road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the big takeaways there is expand what you're looking at in the way of asset class in general and expand out into other forms of commercial. And then kind of one of the underlying themes that I heard throughout that you didn't really say anything specifically about, but it seems to always come back to that, to the market analysis.
It does to me,
like, you know, even the wrong street corner in the right neighborhood throws the whole deal off, right?
Absolutely. It absolutely does. And again, we're at a point in the pandemic where we have some data. Now it's funny, like I'm used to looking at all this data analytics and I pull up these reports that I'm used to seeing, you know, year in, year out, and it still blows my mind. Like my eyes just do this like big jumbo balling thing when I see that unemployment rate just like stretch this long line of unemployment. I'm like, oh my God, that's so crazy. But that's the world we live in now. Mm-hmm. So, but let me tell you, all of the nation is not equal, right? We are currently, I think today the average unemployment is 11.1% nationwide, right? That doesn't mean it's the same in all markets. You have some markets where the average unemployment is 29%. Okay. Yeah, wow. Don't invest there.
Yeah.
And if you're there, then, you know, do your best to hunker down, you know, get out if you can or hunker down, but it's going to be a long road for that market. But there's other markets like ding, 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 Utah, which is at 5.1% unemployment. Mm-hmm. You can look it up on the BLS website, 5.1%. That's the second lowest in the nation. Only, I think it's Kentucky is lower, right? Mm-hmm. And then look at the actual city and county. What is, so the state is one thing, but then you want to get hyper local, like you were speaking about, Tate. Mm-hmm. And this Flex Industrial deal that we just put out is in Davis County. Well, the unemployment rate in Davis County, it's a white collar area, is 4.7% in the pandemic. Okay.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It was 2.1% pre-pandemic, and it's got those strong market fundamentals that it already had in place. Is what's kept it down. And I believe, I mean, between you live in Utah, so you would know, I personally believe that the unemployment rate has stayed so low in Utah in general, because they never fully shut down. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a benefit to those states. I think there's evidence of that now. Another state that never fully shut down that has strong unemployment rates right now is Arizona. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at those markets, I think Arizona is also quite low if you're diving into that data. So that's what I would encourage people to do is really take a look and understand the industries that are the fundamental industries of those areas are, you know, within, are hopefully they're very diversified, mm-hmm. but you want to be looking for places that are focused on tech. Tech is huge. So, you know, fintech, prop tech, you know, and tech hubs are projected to survive COVID much, much better, but not all tech hubs are created equal. We know that, that there, because people can now work from home and it's projected they're going to be able to work from home for a long time. There is a de-densifying of the workforce that, so, and I'm not saying that people want to go live in the mountains. First of all, the internet connection is not good enough. So let's all agree. Okay.
Totally.
But people still love a city. All right. But do they love living in a densely packed, thus risky COVID city like New York, LA, San Francisco, that are also very high priced for rent? No. So what cities are going to be the most attractive are going to be those tech hubs that are cities that are innovative, that are vibrant, that have things going on. And those are cities that are like Salt Lake City, Provo, Raleigh, Durham. These are cities that are going to be drawing talent. And if they're more affordable to live, they've got beautiful outdoors. So I guess I would encourage people, put on your hat and your thinking cap and say, where would people want to live post-COVID? And it is not true that everybody just wants to move to the suburbs, you know?
Right.
Look at the way the states are taxing people. California is very difficult to live these days. The taxes are so high, you know, that people are moving, people are leaving, and they're going to different places. Same thing with New York. The taxes are so high, and you know, if people are spreading out. So yeah, you can look at the data and look at jobs. I think it's really, and Neil says this, and I completely agree with him. The most important the most important metric to look at these days is jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And because that's going to be one of the biggest variables through all of this.
Right.
And determining factors of, you know, economic health in general.
Yeah. I mean, if people don't have jobs, they can't keep their houses in that area. That brings down the value of your houses because there's more foreclosures. And, you know, it's no longer about population growth at this moment in time, you know, because if a location has the jobs, that's where the population is going, right? It's going to be a natural magnet.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you talk about Utah. I do want to hit on that because a lot of our listeners are in Utah. I'm in Utah and we love the market here. However, pre-COVID, what my company was focused on was the Columbus, Ohio's and the San Antonio's and the Oklahoma cities.
No idea why. I have no idea why we were focused in Utah.
On Utah. Well, and the model that we were going with was a pretty strong momentum play model, cash flow model.
Mm-hmm. You were going after value add, correct?
Well, we were definitely wanted some value add for sure, but we wanted assets that performed really well against the sales price. So we wanted, you know, higher cap rate, obviously, to make that work. Mm-hmm. And in Utah, you just aren't finding that. And you're also not finding the scale of unit count. Typically in Utah.
We were building in Utah. So that's the difference. It's very difficult to buy in Utah. So most of our pre-COVID projects that are multifamily in Utah were new construction.
Yeah. Yeah. So we are, you know, our thinking around our models has changed quite a bit since COVID because we kind of, I guess, got slapped in the face a little bit, like you just slapped me in the face, where it's like,
did I?
Well, not really. No,
I don't recall that.
No. Just in terms of like, hey, you're in Utah. This is one of the top two markets in the country, or whatever, right now. Like, and you know it, and we the market well. You know, capital investors here. You know, lenders here, property management, et cetera. Like,
the market fundamentals have been phenomenal for Utah for the past 4 or 5 years. I mean, it just has such a great story. You know.
Right. Right. And we've got you talked about tech at length there. We've got this area called Silicon Slopes,
I talked about it in our webinars. I'm big on Silicon Slopes. Yeah. And then all of the associated logistics. Your airport has a $3.6 billion expansion.
Yeah.
That doesn't just happen.
No.
No. That's because of growth.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. You go to, say, an Albuquerque and walk through their ghost town of an airport that's 40 years old or whatever. It's, and then come to Salt Lake and see all the cranes and the dump trucks and everything. As you mentioned, around the airport is just insane right now.
Yeah. And I don't know how, what your experience is in looking for units in, you know, apartment units in Utah right now, but we were just looking at a Yardi report that showed that it's actually at Salt Lake. So the price per unit at the end of 2019 in Salt Lake was about the national average, about 170K. Mm-hmm. And now in 2020, so we're now, you know, at end of second quarters when this report came out, it had gone up to $250 per unit from 170. And the national average that was at the same point had dipped off because of the pandemic. So the national average had gone down to like 150, and Salt Lake City had skyrocketed up during a pandemic.
Yeah.
So investment dollars are coming to Salt Lake. Right. There's no, I mean, that there's, it's very obvious that, that a lot of capital is coming into Salt Lake. So good luck with finding for stuff at a good price.
But, yeah. At what I think we're seeing a lot of is a lot of 1031 money coming to Salt Lake that needs a good place to call home and is happy with a five cap or five and a quarter, and in a high growth market that has just a ton of upside. We love it here. And I think we've kind of seen the light to a certain degree. That said, I have a goal to own 1,000 units here in the next 3 to 5 years is my target. And I don't see, well, I, you know, we're under contract on a 20 unit right now in Clearfield. Mm-hmm. And that's in the Hill Air Force base area of Davis County, where you all are investing. And yeah, and it's a class C minus property that is, you know, really in need of TLC big time. So it's
that seems like it could be a great find, Tate.
It is, and it's particularly interesting because it's got a land subdivide component where we're going to be able to either do flex industrial, as a matter of fact.
Nice.
Or we're going to be able to do townhomes, and it kind of comes down to what the city lets us do and wants us to do there. After this conversation today, I'm way more open to flex industrial in that spot.
Yeah.
Even more so than townhomes. And that's saying a lot, because that's an area that townhome projects are going up left and right, and there's a lot of demand.
Well, I mean, if it was me in that situation, I'm going to go back to the data, right? Because the project we just did for the flex industrial, it wasn't zoned for townhomes. So it wasn't like, you know, we could say, well, which is the better? So I haven't analyzed whether it's the best usage of that property. So
go back
to data.
Right. Exactly. And we would be assembling two pieces, one of which is zoned commercial industrial and the other, which is zoned multifamily. Mm-hmm. And the city is a wonderful city to work with, and is very pro development and loves what we're going to do to the apartment building, and wants to work with us on this other piece. So it's a fun project. We're really excited about it, and we can, you know, it's something we can definitely see keeping as in terms of the apartment building long term, and keeping as part of our portfolio. Getting to 1,000 doors, 20 doors at a time is going to be tough. So
yeah,
you got to
bite off some projects as you go. I mean, you know, we just closed that project in Houston a short while ago, and I mean, that was 32 units. And some people might be like, well, what are you guys doing buying building a 32 unit? You guys are building a 240 unit. You guys have so many units. Why would you do that? Well, you've got to be nimble and you've got to be flexible in this environment. And there's no shame in a 20 unit building, Tate Seymour.
Yeah.
So
I appreciate that.
You should be proud of yourself. You've got a project that has opportunity to grow, and you should embrace that. And I also want to say, as a person who has 1800 units, who cares how many units people have? You know, I think people get too caught up in that. You know, some people will tout that they have, you know, 3,000 units. And then when you really like get into the weeds with them, they're like a minute portion of a minute portion. They've never been to a meeting. They like, maybe they were a money raiser for like $100,000 on a bunch of different projects, and they're claiming they've got 3,000 units. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think in this industry, the concept of how many units you have is really overrated.
Yeah.
So I think you need to come up with a different way of assessing that, your goal,
a different metric.
So, yeah, I think a different metric would be a good way to go about it.
Yeah. And it really is, at the end of the day, it's all about passive income.
I agree.
And I
think more income-based or worth-based is a better way to look at it. You know,
not worth-based. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm going to integrate that and plug that
Sorry,
in.
Sorry. Did I just slap you in the face again?
Not again. Not at all. No, you didn't slap me in the face before, just to be clear, but COVID slapped us in the face though, in all seriousness, because it really did drive us to the realization that we are where we need to be right now, as far as in the right market. And
yes, you are definitely in the right market.
Yeah. So
I wish I was in that market. I mean, we're not going to buy anything in San Francisco. Even if the prices get crazy good. I mean, it's just the business environment for real estate is not compelling to us. We won't invest in California. So where does that leave us? Right. We have to look, you know, invest in places like Utah and Arizona and Atlanta, et cetera.
Can I ask you about Columbus real quick?
Just because
I kind of geek out on Columbus, Ohio a little bit.
Sure, you're probably going to have to geek mostly on your own. I mean, I know some basic stuff. I don't know the details of how Columbus is doing in this pandemic and things, you know, things have changed so dramatically. But I know Columbus is a solid market.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I've kind of thought of Columbus as a little bit of a unicorn market in terms of the affordability compared to the job diversification and the net median household income is impressive there.
Yeah, so. I know it's the only market in Ohio that we would consider. Yeah. It's one of the only markets in Ohio that hasn't been losing population. You know, if you go back, so that's, you know, go back to 2000, it's like everybody's moving to Columbus, but all of the other markets are basically losing population. So that's of no interest to us. But I would also say that there's many reports that we see that say the Midwest is going to be the big winner post-COVID. And I don't know. I mean, I'm more focused on the tech hubs. I'd have to dig into that data a little bit, but I have seen that comment. I just couldn't speak to what's behind that. So maybe do a little search on that, because I think Columbus is one of the best of the Midwest that we're aware of, that, you know, that we would be all in for.
Yeah.
So I would research that.
Yeah, we've got some good relationships there with brokers and some property managers. I'm from Cincinnati originally.
Okay.
So,
and then you left?
I left 20 years ago.
So there's that leaving all the other Ohio cities, right?
I know. It's and Cincinnati is actually growing, I believe, very slowly right now.
Now it's growing. But if you go back to 2000, you know.
Right. Yeah. Right. So I know you don't have a crystal ball here, but you know, you hear a lot of people, a lot of the thought leaders in this space talking about the next 6 months. There's going to be great opportunities coming up. Do you subscribe to that? Do you see like some really motivated, desperate sellers that are going to need to make a move or?
Well, I think the landscape is shifting. I think we are starting to see prices fall just at the beginning. We're just at the beginning of that. I think what happens is really going to be telling in the next 2 months. So what the government does in terms of whether they provide another stimulus package and the extension of unemployment benefits, like what that means, that's going to be, you know, really, and then whether the eviction moratorium gets expanded, those are things that are going to have a big impact, I believe, on real estate investors that have tenants. So that's going to be interesting to watch. But then you're going to have people who are maybe mom and pop real estate investors that had a business or whatever, and they lost that business. So then now they've got to sell their property. So I do believe that there is going to be opportunity. Mm-hmm. We are looking, so we're always, you know, we're ready for that opportunity. I would say that we're looking at this next 6 to 12 months as a ramp, but we don't know where that opportunity lays. So we're always, you know, trying to be on the cutting edge and not looking necessarily where everybody else is looking. Mm-hmm. So, but I think that you have to be very careful about debt. And so we are looking at the debt markets with eagle eyes, because that can be your biggest risk. Right. Mm-hmm. So debt is challenging right now. The way Fannie and Freddie have the additional escrows, a lot of people are just making light of that. And it does introduce a risk, right? Mm-hmm. So how you leverage your project is critical. And I would encourage people not to get caught up in too high of interest rates, thinking that, oh, this is a screaming deal, so I'm just going to get this 8% bridge loan and it's all going to work out. I just think that that's too risky. If it's your own money, fine. That's your own money. You can do whatever you want. But if you're using other people's money, I think that's irresponsible to take investors with you on that road. So yeah, I think it's really a lot about debt.
Yeah. You know, again, one of the things I so appreciate about your companies, Multifamily U and Grow Capitus and Neil and you, is how generous you are with sharing your expertise and your knowledge. And I just encourage listeners to check out growcapitus.com and multifamilyu.com, because you guys do seminars at least once a week.
Yeah, we have a lot of webinars that you'll hear my voice quite a bit. I'm the host of a lot of guests that come on, and they're educational. So it's actually, we're teaching content, or they're teaching content that we think is valuable for people that are interested in multifamily, but it's also just interesting for real estate investors in general. We are strong believers in empowerment through education, and that's what Neil and I are all about. So, and then we have our quarterly boot camp that is a paid boot camp 4 times a year. But we put out a ton of free content because we want people to make good decisions. We want people to themselves learn how to become empowered with data, and we just are givers that way.
Yeah, you sure are. So again, guys, check out Anna and Neil's webinars, their content. Follow them on Facebook. What's the best way to follow you guys?
Facebook, it's multi. I think we're just getting our YouTube. I mean, we're on everything, but our YouTube is kind of just getting going. We're not as, you know, proactive on that front. We have a Facebook channel on Multifamily University. And then we've got a secret channel that's for the people that have been in our boot camp. So only the people that have the same level of education that we've provided, only those people are in that get into that secret one. So yeah, I mean, I'd say basically if you engage with us through, go to the website, sign up for a webinar, you'll see multiple channels, because some people prefer LinkedIn. Like we got a lot going on LinkedIn. We're on Instagram. Like, pick your channel, but just get engaged.
Yeah. And just get on the mailing list, the email list, I'd say, because you're not going to miss anything.
We're avid. we do send out lots. We've got a lot of material we send out for sure.
Yeah. Just a couple of last questions here, I guess, kind of in light of what we've been talking about with the pandemic and the change in the climate recently and the rapidly changing climate all the time. What advice would you give for somebody that's just getting started or wants to get started?
Well, the advice I would give to that person is, first of all, you are coming in at an amazing time because there will be opportunity coming up. So this is the time to get educated. Prices haven't fallen yet, but this is the time to dig in, educate. If you have extra hours in your life because of a job change, or you think your life is giving you more hours, spend that time educating yourself so that when the opportunity comes up, you are ready. If you're interested in going into a multifamily space, you also are going to need to partner with people, because it is a team sport. So you should also be looking for like-minded people and going to virtual Zoom room coffees with them to see if you can find people that you would like to be in business with, because multifamily is a business. So you can be setting up all that groundwork, education, networking, building your team. Yep. So that when the opportunities come, you are ready to pounce.
Yeah. And that's all brilliant. And I would just add to that, kind of in relation to, get as much mentorship as you can during this time. Get on somebody's team if you got to work for free. We talk about that a fair amount here. Like, you know, bring whatever super skill, superpower that you have to somebody's team and provide value to them. And that's definitely a foot in the door to this whole game.
Well, you know, Tate, that's how I became Neil Bauer's business partner.
Oh,
yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So I met Neil at a boot camp. It was like his second virtual boot camp. And I, you know, saw him speak at a conference, and I was like, this guy's brilliant. Like, I totally get him, his whole data thing. I'm like, yeah, this. And so then he was doing a boot camp. It was only like $250 or something for, I was like, that's crazy. I'm taking it. So it was an e-boot camp. I met him through there. I just soaked it up like a sponge. And he asked at one point for volunteers to write a deal analyzer. Okay. Like an Excel spreadsheet. Right. And I'm like, deal analyzer, Excel programmer, 18 years, got this. Right. So then you get a one-on-one phone call with Neil as part of your boot camp. And so as soon as I got on the phone with him, I'm like, hey, I volunteered, but nobody's followed up with me. And I want you to understand my background. I've led like worldwide teams, programmer, systems architect, blah, blah, blah. And he says to me, great, you're my lead. You're my lead for the project. I'm like, oh, okay. So I, of course, on a volunteer basis, was the volunteer team lead to, you know, build this analyzer. And I had this band of other people that had also volunteered. Many had no experience in Excel, no experience in anything. So it was, of course, an interesting combination. And I was reporting back via email regularly to Neil, maybe 3 times a week, giving him status. And he eventually said on one of the emails, he replied and he said, I just, good report. I just want you to know, I don't care if the analyzer ever gets made. I want to work with you. And I was just like, what? That's crazy. And now I was still a photographer at this time because I was working my way out of my studio, right? Mm-hmm. So I was only photographing 3 or 4 days a week. And then I was spending all the rest of my time digging into real estate, educating myself, spending every minute. I wasn't being paid for any of it. Mm-hmm. So then he offered me to do some underwriting for him. Again, volunteer. So that's how I started out. The first 9 months of my business relationship with Neil, it was all volunteer. Mm-hmm. And 12 months later, I was the vice president of the company.
That is an amazing story. So for listeners, you've got an absolute rock star sitting here talking to you about and sharing with you everything she knows about the different subjects we've been talking about. And look where she started.
Yeah.
You know, it's a fantastic success story. And
it's all about giving, right?
Right.
And I was learning so much. I wasn't trying to become the vice president. I was trying to learn as much as I could and add as much value as I could. And that's where it got me. I didn't have an agenda, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Other than giving and learning.
Yeah. That's perfect. One last question, and then we'll let you go. I know you're such a busy woman. What legacy do you want to leave in relationship to commercial real estate?
Well, I want my children and my grandchildren to, first of all, receive the benefits of all of my hard work and my family before me's hard work. But I want them to understand how business works and how to scale. Mm-hmm. I want people to understand that, and especially my family to understand that you can create a life with real estate that is unique, that is very difficult to create in any other field, because it can give you so much freedom to do other things and be other things. You know, I definitely wish I had started in the commercial real estate earlier, but you can still be a doctor, a teacher, a whatever, you know, fill in the blank, whatever your passion is, and invest on the side and create a much better life for yourself in your future that allows you to do so many more things. So that's the legacy that I want my children and my grandchildren to understand the nature of business and the nature of real estate and the power of it, so that they can utilize it in their lives and my great-grandchildren's lives, my great-great-grandchildren's lives, and to keep going.
That is a powerful vision. That's it's a powerful why.
Yeah.
In terms of why you're doing what you're doing. Well, Anna, thank you so much for sharing what you've shared with us and with the listeners and with me. I learned a ton today, and even about our own projects here. This has been inspiring and you know, expansive for me in terms of thinking about different asset classes, quite frankly, and kind of pulling that into the data market or into the data analysis and just kind of pushing it through the computer, so to speak, and seeing if it works, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, anytime you want to talk about Utah, I'm your girl. We love Utah. So we're always chatting it up about Utah.
Okay. Well, we're looking for deals all the time out here, and you'll be at the top of our list.
Awesome.
I'll be in touch. So once again, Anna, thank you so much. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in and listening to the end of the podcast. It's always great to get to share with you, and especially somebody like Anna, who brings so much value. Go check her out at multifamilyu.com and growcapitus.com.
Yeah. And that's GRO. Well, you can see it right there. GROCAPITUS. A lot of people add that extra W. We don't need a W. We're more modern than that.
Yeah, you're more hip than that. You don't need a capital G either.
No capital G's around here.
I love that. All right, Anna. Well, thanks so much. Have a beautiful weekend, and
you too.
We'll be in touch.
Thanks, Tate.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.